If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
How do I raise capital from people that I don't know? That's not necessarily a skill set that everyone has. You can be a great operator, doesn't mean you know how to raise capital. And so just at the time where people are like, hey, I'm ready to go big, shoot, I need a capital partner. You know, sometimes I'm sitting there like, hey, I just wave, hey, I'm here. I've been watching you. Hey, I can be that capital partner for you, right?
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Eric Tate is a practicing physician in internal medicine in a private practice in Houston, Texas. He is the founder and fund manager of Vernonville Asset Management, which has developed numerous income-producing investment projects, both domestically and internationally. Vernonville Asset Management was born because Eric could not find any investment products that he felt were suitable for his own portfolio. His motto is, if you find a need, fill it. Eric, welcome to the show.
Hey, man, thanks.
Absolutely, man, absolutely. There's so many places we can take this today. You know, the same questions I ask everybody who comes on, though, is where did you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
Yeah, absolutely. So this really started for me in business school. Once I learned how to kind of do an evaluation on public companies and realized that stock prices had nothing to do with the actual underlying value of the company, I decided I didn't want my money there. And so once I got out of residency, finished medical school, finished residency, started buying single family homes, like many people, small unit and then small unit apartment complexes. And so that's really where I started out, was kind of, you know, neighborhood rent man. Even though I was a practicing physician, I still carved out enough time to do that. And then it just evolved from that standpoint. As I got more proficient on the smaller projects, we had some physician colleagues who approached us about wanting to invest with us. And so with more money, you can actually do larger projects.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, most of the time, from what I've heard from a lot of physicians and or chiropractors or anybody in the medical field, you're so overwhelmed getting out of school and getting your practice started that you don't think that longer term. You know, it seems like the light bulb generally comes on later in life for a lot of people in your industry that says, oh, wait, I need to stop trading time for money. How did you figure that out early on?
Well, I was lucky. I started medical school in 1998. And it just so happened a little purple book was written in 1997. And my college roommate called me because we had these conversations in college. He was like, hey, man, you need to read this book. The stuff we were talking about, this guy makes it plainly clear. And so as Robert Kiyosaki was writing his books, I was actually going through training. So I was literally in medical school reading Rich Dad Poor Dad. I was in business school reading The Cashflow Quadrant, right? And so it opened my mind up to a separate track. So not the formal kind of financial education I was getting in business school, this kind of different financial education. And so I was able to compare and contrast the two from that standpoint. So from day one, the trading time for dollars was something that I was not interested in doing.
Wow. Good for you. Good for you. So what's your business look like today?
It's interesting. And so the way we've set up the company now is kind of, I like to say that we're the alternative investment platform for busy professionals. And so we have kind of real estate as kind of a large portion of what we do. We also have private debt. So we create private debt notes. And then we also do some angel investing. And so what I found was that not everybody just wants real estate. Mm-hmm. Lots of people do want to create a well-rounded portfolio that doesn't just focus on the publicly traded markets and doesn't also just focus necessarily on real estate. But still, real estate is a big portion of what we do. And so we do a lot of commercial projects, flex industrial or light industrial, triple net commercial. We've built some student housing that right now in the middle of trying to pivot with that because of COVID. I still have dozens of single family homes. Don't have any apartments. We've sold kind of most of our apartments off at this point, looking to get in maybe back in at better valuations. We'll have to see. But, you know, we own hotels. We own some income producing farmland. So we're kind of, I would like to say, asset class agnostic in many ways. And that's just because the way we look at the market, the asset just fills a market need. And so for us, we're looking for great markets that have specific needs. And then we will then look to partner with people to put those assets on the ground in those markets from that standpoint.
Wow, that's awesome. That's awesome. I love the way you look at that. Are you active operators in these spaces, or are you finding other operators in the space and you guys are coming as the capital partners?
Yeah, so I used to be an active operator. I realize I hate minutiae like that, so I don't do that anymore. My job is macroeconomic evaluation and due diligence, and then investor relations, right? And so I'm bringing capital to the table because I can evaluate operators because I am an operator, right? But I do not like operations anymore like that. And so I can look at a deal from an operator standpoint, so I know where the bodies are buried, and then I can understand if these guys really know what they're doing, or are they just kind of first time out, you know, they're about to take this ride, and I'm not going to let our money take that ride with them because they don't know what they don't know yet. So we're really doing mostly capital allocation at this point, with me choosing who the operators are going to be and choosing the markets that we're going to be in.
Right. No, that's super fascinating. What's the structure like on that?
So it depends on the project, right? And so I keep it very asset light at my level. So it's me, and I have a CPA that does kind of all of our back office K-1s and things of that nature. And then the team, because I'm an operator, I can do my own analysis of the deal. So once I have a deal, I'm like, hey, you know, give me the co-star, give me all of that. So I can run the numbers personally myself and have a clear kind of understanding from that standpoint. And then because we're doing, let's just say, the large commercial projects, I've already met the management team is going to be running that. You probably have already done a podcast with them. I understand kind of the assets that they have, their historical track record from that standpoint. So I know who the management team is, where we're going to be. From that standpoint. And so, you know, for me, it's just doing a lot of the due diligence around it. And because these are passive income deals, we've got full-time property management already in place. So they're running that kind of day-to-day. My general partners themselves usually have lots of other assets themselves. So we're talking probably once a month, once a quarter around kind of what the plans are, you know, who we're going to use for cost segregation, what, you know, these kind of things. So we're each bringing our own Rolodex to the table from that standpoint.
Right. No, that's absolutely fascinating. So you guys bring the capital to the table. Are you setting that up as a fund, or is it something you're setting up as each individual asset you're buying in its own LLC, typical to a syndication?
Yep, we're doing each individual. So what we do is allow our investors to choose kind of how they're going to create their own individual portfolio. So we're not doing blind pools as of yet, right? Now, I will say, on our venture side, we have a semi-blind pool, but it's a different discussion for a different day. But on the real estate side, it is, you know, we have a group of investors. We'll say, hey, this is our next project. For those who want in, let us know. And so you do not have to take a ride with us across projects that you yourself don't want to be a part of.
Right, right. What are some problems you've run into with this model and growing it?
Yeah. So early on, choosing, and it was interesting, and I'll leave the specific project out to shield the innocent / guilty. I've gotten a lot better at choosing operational partners over time. And so the biggest issue, I will say, is understanding the balance sheet of your operational partner with their expectations if something goes wrong. Right now, you know, we can't, you know, COVID is a special situation that caused a lot of issues in some things. Interestingly enough, it didn't cause a lot of issues on our commercial or industrial projects, which was very interesting. And we can have a conversation about that if you want to. But understanding the wherewithal of your partners and the potential needs for capital calls that, I'll be honest, should not come to the limited partners. It should stay at the operational partners level, making sure that they're solvent through, that they can be solvent through a downturn that lasts 6 months to a year. So that's one of the biggest things that I had to learn in this process from that standpoint.
What do you require of an operating partner in order to verify their ability to remain solvent without going to the limited partners for a capital call?
Balance sheets.
Right.
Balance sheets. Understanding exactly what they're in. And because we tend to deal with operators who have history, they've got assets, they've got cash flowing assets. You can see kind of how they've operated those assets through a few downturns. And again, a lot of it is just backtesting through the beauty of CoStar and all of those due diligence reports is I can look back through 2008, 9, 10, 11, right? I can see how the marketplace operated during those downturns. So that's why for us, the market is the dominant factor, because technically the partner or team member is fungible, right? You can move them in and out. You cannot move a market, right? And so understanding what a good market will save you and can save you from even bad operators if need be. And so we focus heavily, heavily on the market side of things, and then it rolls down to the team.
Right, right. No, that's interesting. So it sounds like you guys got caught at a point where there were capital calls to the limited partners.
No, I've shielded them from that. I've just told the operators, dude, you're going to have to eat this, or it will have to be that money will have to end up being generated back through the asset once you get it where it needs to be. Because again, I'm not going to go into the details of that particular deal because it's a fairly public project. It's not here in the United States. And it was one of our early projects. And so, you know, and if it comes down to it, we'll go to court. I don't, you know, it doesn't matter to me from that standpoint. So, but there's some recapitalization that's happening on the back of the limited partners that to me is just wrong. And I just won't be a part of. And so we'll have to figure that out down the road.
Right. Right. No, man, those are, I mean, those are the things that, I think, you know, I always say you don't trust anybody that's never made a mistake or that's never had problems because you just, you don't know how they're going to deal with it.
So that's correct.
I always ask those questions because I think those are the things we learn the most from. You just mentioned something that was really fascinating. You said that was not a domestic project. That was an international project. What's it like investing internationally?
And so in one respect, it's been great. In another respect, it's been frustrating, but it will ultimately be good because we picked the correct market, right? Mm. And so, and we told investors this was a, you know, 5 to 7 year project after kind of our phases opened up. So we knew it was going to be a 10-year project, but the kind of project it is a legacy project that will be around for 30, 40 plus years, right? Oh, wow. So if you've ever gone to kind of the Cayman Islands, you know, 7 Mile Beach and things and places like that, it will be an iconic project like that over time, right? And so what we're losing now is opportunity cost, but we won't lose when it's all said and done, right? And so that's kind of the mindset that I have to take with it. And that's the mindset that we let investors know on the front end, but we're still behind where we want to be on that particular project, right? Like I said, it was early on, but there's this extra level of due diligence that has to be done. So now you're talking about political risk. Now you're talking about kind of building risk. I mean, because it was a ground up development in essentially a developing country, right? And so while the timing ended up running well in terms of construction, there were other things out of our control that did not. And so again, we're behind where performer wise we want to be, but we've got the capital gains kind of locked in because the things are built and things are there. And so now it's just a matter of fine tuning operations from that standpoint. So yeah, but I would say on the international front, be very, very, very careful. Get a team that has done it before successfully, not just done something internationally to put on their resume, but has actually had an operating thing there, whatever that thing is, and has had the experience. So I can flip side it with kind of our agricultural project, which is also overseas. That team had done it before, not under their own banner. They had done it for someone else. So they then turned around and started to do it, but already had the experience of knowing what they needed to do. And so that experience has been very different in terms of hitting in the timing of things. Now, COVID did affect that a little bit just because people couldn't come into the country to buy the product. So it needed to be shipped off. But ultimately, the product is there. It's just a matter of now finding a new market to sell it in, which will be fine in the next 1 or 2 years. So that one is not a big deal. So I can juxtapose kind of the operational capacities of both teams to know if we do something like that again, what that ultimately needs to look like.
Right, right. That's interesting. Yeah, farmland is one of those things. I've not had anybody come on yet that invests in farmland, but it sounds like yours is not just farmland. Maybe it's a crop or something that is.
It's specialty coffee. And so, and the good thing about that is if you look at worldwide demand for it, it's going through the roof. If you look at kind of the places where it can grow from a climate change standpoint, those places are going away. And so we own the land and we partner with the operations team to farm it. And then essentially 20% off the top goes to the workers. So, you know, there's a workers bonus pool that's off the top to kind of increase their standard of living in that country. And then we split the rest.
Wow. That's really cool. That's really cool. Yeah. I wonder, like, how did you find that team? And then how did you pick that particular, I know we've kind of gone through this a little bit already, but I think that one's a unique one.
So I'm a big seminar guy, right? So I'm a big seminar junkie. I you know, pre-COVID, I would go to, you know, multiple seminars a year. I do a lot of personal development work. And so for me, going to investment seminars is where I meet people who also feel the same way, right? I like being around people who are lifelong learners. I trust those people because they're going to be on the cutting edge of what's happening. And so, you know, in your travels, you meet people, you stay in contact with them. You know, I make a lot of due diligence trips on the ground. So I'd fly down there, do my own due diligence, go on whatever tours they may or may not have, do my own independent research, and then do that a couple of times. Usually I'm not going to be the first money in. So we'll, and when you're not the first money in, you don't get the biggest upside, which we're okay with. But seeing that they're actually performing the way they were supposed to perform, and then once they reach that hurdle, saying, okay, you're doing it this way, you know, we can bring in X amount of capital to kind of inject kind of some fuel onto this fire very quickly. does that make sense for you? And so, and then that's how we move forward from that standpoint.
Yeah, that's interesting. You said not the first money in. What does that mean? And how do you do that practically and yet still retain opportunity?
Well, you know, it's one of those things, right? It's a matter of finding what an operator needs, right? And so it, eventually everybody runs out of money. That's just one of those things. Unless you're getting institutional capital, everybody ultimately runs out of money. So the opportunity isn't necessarily going to go away if they're going to go at scale, right? And the beauty is it's inverse, right? The better you get at it, the quicker you're going to run out of money, because you're going to use your own money oftentimes or the money in your closest circle for your early projects, right? Because those are only people who really know you. But once you're good at it, now you have to figure out, how do I raise capital from people that I don't know? That's not necessarily a skill set that everyone has. You can be a great operator, doesn't mean you know how to raise capital. And so just at the time where people are like, hey, I'm ready to go big, shoot, I need a capital partner. You know, sometimes I'm sitting there like, hey, I just wave, hey, I'm here, I've been watching you. Hey, I can be that capital partner for you, right? And so capital raising is not easy, right? It is literally a function and a job all in and of itself. People lump together operations and capital raising because many people try to do the two together, but they're not the same thing. There are operators and then there are capital raisers, right? I would argue that the people that can mix the two and at least have thought about it are better at doing these things, just thinking of projects from an investor standpoint in terms of how they structure them. And then the flip side, as a capital raiser, thinking about a project from, hey, will these operations actually go through? But understanding what each party needs, so understanding what investors need and understanding what the operators need, that's kind of where I sit, right? And that's where understanding that, okay, you now have figured out how to do this. You probably are going to want to go fast now. Well, the way you're going to go fast is by having the ability to have a couple million dollars dropped on you each project with no fuss, no muss, one check. You're only dealing with one person. And that's kind of what I offer.
Right. That's fascinating. What are some things that you feel like you've done right that you would suggest other people follow in your footsteps on?
Just in terms of, so were you talking about capital raising or just real estate investing in general?
Anything. It's your story. Tell it how you want.
Yeah. So I would say the first thing was putting my own money out first and learning how to do this, learning how to actually make a dollar in real estate personally before ever even thinking about bringing other money in, bringing other people's money in, either bringing family money in, right? It's not necessarily a direct correlation, but once you've actually had to do this, deal with contractors, put whole deals together, even if they're small deals, they don't have to be huge, right? But once you've done it and on a repeatable pace, going up to scale, the work isn't any harder. It's just a little bit different, right? You're just changing your perspective a little bit. You have to change kind of some of the metrics you're looking at, but ultimately it's still the same work. And so I would always say, get out there, put your own money at risk first, learn how to actually do this first before you would ever take a dime from anyone else.
No, that's good. That's good. Anything else on that front as far as maybe that does pertain to raising capital, but is there anything else on that front you'd say, hey, here's some things I did right?
Yeah, I paid for mentorship, right? Mm. I mean, I've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on mentorship to learn the actual skills of the things that I wanted to do. So going to seminars, joining investment clubs, joining mentorship programs. Now, the key is you have to find the right ones and find ones that are giving you the skills that you want to learn, not what they want to sell you, right? And that takes a little bit of discernment. You're going to have to kiss a couple frogs from that standpoint. But do not be afraid to go out there and pay to learn a skill.
Right. No, that's great. That's absolutely great. Eric, I've thoroughly enjoyed this. My gosh, you've done a lot of things, and it seems like in a short period of time, and that's admirable. One day, maybe I'll get to the level that you're at. So that's super cool. Let's jump here into the final four, if we can. What is one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring investor?
Be a lifelong learner. Always be learning your craft, because new things come out, new things happen, new funding mechanisms happen, laws change. Be an astute person of your craft and always be learning.
Love that. What is one way you are staying on top of your game?
Again, staying on top of what's happening in my specific industry. So for me, we do a lot of tax strategy for our investors. And so understanding the tax side of things, understanding other investments that my investors are looking at and how to help them create a portfolio to balance out maybe some of the risks they don't even realize that they're taking. And so again, for me, it's going to be the same thing, just staying on top of my craft at all times.
Let's pause here for a second, because you said you will look at another and some maybe some other investments that your investors are considering. How do you look at those and analyze what risks they might be taking that they're not aware of and have a meaningful conversation around that?
Yeah. So, you know, I went to business school, right? So I understand the public securities markets. And so I understand capital asset pricing models. I understand all of those things. Whereas they are put out in the world as, you know, it's essentially a riskless return. You just put your money in an index fund and call it a day. Like there's no systemic risk. There's no correlation risk between stocks and bonds in the publicly traded markets, right? And so unless you're able to explain to people that this is a fishbowl, think of the publicly traded markets as a fishbowl. And if you look at what happened in 08 and 09, everything dropped, which technically goes against efficient kind of market hypothesis and creating an efficient portfolio, right?
Sure.
As one thing's dropped, something else is supposed to at least go up or maintain. That's not what happened because we have two tightly correlated asset classes in the public markets. And people aren't aware of that. And so making people aware of that and understanding where their risk in the portfolio, if they're completely overweighted the public markets, most people don't realize that that's a massive risk.
Right. Right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I wonder that I'm sure it's an enlightening conversation when you review someone's portfolio and say, hey, what about?
Yeah.
And they go, oh my goodness. And number three is when it comes to investing in the world, what is one way you're making the world a better place?
So what we try to be is great stewards within the communities that we're in. If you ever see one of our investment presentations, we always talk about Main Street and not Wall Street, right? Mm. You know, bypassing kind of the place where value is not created in many ways and taking our dollars directly to the people who may need it, right? And so if we look at it from the standpoint of what I talked about, even outside of the United States, so what I talked about in our coffee investment, that we literally have built new housing, new shelter. We're sending our workers' kids to school, right? I mean, there's a whole social component to this that we were doing 4 or 5 years ago before this whole ESG thing was super big. We were already doing that. And in our hotel project, we were, I think, the third highest employer in the country when we were fully ramped up and all was being said and done. And they're in a bonus pool and those kinds of things. And then even now, like through COVID, right? We as real investors, not some nameless, faceless REIT, can work with individual tenants to work with them through their situation as opposed to just necessarily locking them out or, you know, pushing them out or those kinds of things, right? And so we aim to be good stewards in each community in which we operate.
Right. That's awesome. That's awesome. Good for you guys. I'm sure that's really rewarding. Eric, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
Probably through the website, honestly. I mean, we have a newsletter that goes out every once every 10 days. So, you know, verninville.com, verninville.com. You can sign up for the newsletter right there, or you can email me through there. That's probably the easiest way to get in contact with me. Or directly from an email standpoint, it's just my name, Eric, E-R-I-C, at verninville.com. for my email.
Eric, thanks so much for your time today. This was great. Certainly appreciate it.
Oh, Sam, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. It was a great time.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.